All right. How we doing this?
Yeah, so what you guys been up to?
I heard you guys mess it up last time.
Oh, yeah?
Like, I go away for a minute. Did we mess up? We can't have nice things around here anymore.
Was it messed up, though? I thought that was the new normal. We just get right into it. Ain't nobody got time for that, so we just, you know, we get right into it.
Man, whatever. This is episode 231.
It is.
And this is a podcast, yep, and you can subscribe to it.
Yeah.
It could be worse, though, because, like, I remember, did you guys ever used to listen to the Accidental Tech podcast? You remember that?
A while back, yeah.
Yeah, long. I haven't listened to it in a minute, but they would, like, it seemed like, to me, that they would turn their mics on, like, mid-conversation, so, like, you just suddenly, you're like, what am I listening to? What are they talking about? Yeah. Like, what, did I miss something? Let me rewind. Nope, that was the beginning.
Yep. That was the hot, or like the hot opening I was used to. The McElroys got me turned on to that.
Oh, okay.
Man.
McElroy brothers.
Yeah. All so, right. I mean, so, it could be worse, Alan.
I think maybe. I don't know. I'm not sure.
Well, you're not twitching, so I think you took your meds. So, I think we're okay.
Yeah. I listened to that last one. I think I was twitching when I listened to it. I was like, really, guys? Really? So, anyways.
I was dying laughing after we hit stop on the record because I'm like, oh my God, when he hears this, it's going to be hilarious. I can't wait for it. Like,
I got hot.
I wanted to see the reaction so bad. I wanted to be in the room when you saw it, when you heard it for the first time.
So ridiculous.
Was it amazing?
Yeah, I know, it was ridiculous. So yeah, I'm Alan Underwood, the guy who likes the intros we used to have.
And I'm the guy reading the reviews. Oh, wait, no, we didn't have any reviews this time. That was a mistake on my part. We didn't have it. So, yeah. But thank you anyways for those that did leave a past review.
Wait, you're not going to tell who you are and who he is?
No, because anonymity. Like, I want
to. Come on, man. Hey, the guy on top up there on my screen is Joe Zach. You want to say hi, Joe?
Hi. How's it going? You know, everyone mixes this up anyway. So
yeah, they do.
But it doesn't matter. It's fine. They do. It's fine.
The funny part is, I'm Joe Zach. You're just messing with everybody.
Yeah. That's Outlaw right there.
Yeah, I'm just kidding.
Can't believe him.
I'm Michael Outlaw, so yeah.
Yeah. All right, so yes, we didn't have any reviews, which made me sad, because apparently we didn't on the previous episode either, so that's two in a row. Like, we're
falling off. We did on the previous.
Did we?
Yeah, we did. That's where I messed up, because I left that name in there from the Susie Mon.
Okay.
From the previous one by accident.
I was going to say, is there anybody out there anymore? Did anybody hear us? So,
I don't know.
Yeah. All right.
They don't like the new open.
That's what it is.
Nobody likes that. Is that what it is?
Nobody likes the new open. We're about to put Boomer Hour up front.
I think the problem has been that the three of us haven't been able to, like, get together, you know, for a while. Like, this year is off to one heck of a start. And so, like, the three of us have had difficulty, like, getting together, and I think it's the lack of mental blocks. That's been the problem.
It might be. It's back tonight, though, so we'll see if that puts us back on track.
Yeah. But Boomer Hour has been popular, so, I mean, you know, if you wanted to move that up to the front, you know, there might be some people okay with that.
I got complaints.
Have complaints for Boomer Hour. Okay.
For Boomer Hour, yes.
I thought you meant you had complaints about Boomer Hour.
No, I appreciate Boomer Hour. It's my therapy every other week, I think.
I don't even know why I didn't notice this, but did you see all the chat about the aux conversation?
No. I didn't understand the aux, by the way. I didn't get it. Were we talking about auxiliary or?
So at the time of the recording, when Jay-Z said it, I happened to be looking at my mixer, and so auxiliary was like what came to mind. So I'm thinking like AUX. But the way he wrote it when he did up the show notes, like, it was OCK. And as I was editing the audio, I was like, oh, wait a minute. I bet he means like part of blocks, like part of the word blocks. And so like it dawned on me, I'm like, oh, that's what he meant. And then someone else in the Slack channel said, oh, I thought he meant OX. Ox.
Yeah.
And like, he was referring to you as the ox.
I was wondering the same thing. Am I like the big bull guy? Like, I'm not, maybe. I don't know. Well, I mean, I was confused.
when you spout a lot of BS. No, just kidding.
I don't think about what I say. Don't read too deep. Yeah, I literally just meant like that's just happened to be where it was, and I thought it was kind of funny that it was an animal, so it just kind of worked. I don't know if you saw the image art I used. Yes. I did generate it, but it was we had talked a little bit about Oregon Trail there, so I found I asked Dolly to make an image of a person on a computer chair being dragged by an ox.
That's beautiful,
along the Oregon Trail.
Although, so that would have confused me further, is what that would have
done. Yeah.
Yeah, but that's where he spelled out the OCKS. But it doesn't, from the picture, it's not apparent that the person is being pulled by it. So it just looks like he's sitting in a chair. It's almost behind like he's like ox. A proctologist or something for an ox. And he's just like, all right, what we got here?
Or maybe it was an ox. Maybe it was a cow that he was about to milk, and you got to be in a chair to do that. To be comfortable. I don't know.
Yeah, you can't really tell it's an ox either. I thought bull when I first saw it, but, you know.
Yeah. I mean, if you remember the original Oregon Trail, you didn't really know what any of that stuff was, if they didn't tell you.
Yeah.
The good old 8-bit days.
Yeah.
You'd be like, your ox broke an ankle fording the river, and you're like, oh, that was an ox. Okay.
So speaking of random Slack conversations, though, I'm hoping this becomes a trend because – I don't know if you saw in general, but my new hero, Jim Hummelstein, he put a picture of him donating blood in there. And I saw that and I'm like, you know what? I hope that this becomes like a trend. Like, how awesome would that be if people regularly give blood and like share their pictures of like, hey, you know, to like encourage other people. So I thought that was pretty awesome when I saw that picture.
Don't play games.
All right, I'll find out where you went, and I'm going to go. I'm going to get me a picture.
I was very proud when you said that you had given blood that day, and that you were in sort of a moron and decided to go out and do some mountain biking later that day because, you know, they're just kidding about, you know, hey, take it easy today. Nah, I got this.
I'm sure that they've told me things like that before in the past, and I just didn't really think about it, or it never like clicked. That is maybe the closest one of those times in my life where I'm like, this is probably the closest to death I'm going to, like
like I probably thought, this guy's 21, he knows that he shouldn't go do this.
Thank you.
Right. Yeah, you're welcome.
Yeah.
All right, so hey, real quick, an update. So I think Grigori had asked about an update on the networking stuff. So the short of it is I haven't actually done anything with it yet, except mapped out a bunch of routes through my ceilings in my house. So a couple of things I'd actually said on Slack in case anybody else even cares or is somewhat interested. So I did buy some of the Omadas, the TP-Link Omada, like, you know, more commercially type things, which surprisingly aren't any more expensive and in many cases are cheaper than what you can get for the out of the box kits, like our Asus ones that Outlaw and I have talked about before. So I bought a couple of those and I bought the long range. I think they were the 6600s or something like that. And then I did get a switch with PoE on it and all that. So I have all the stuff set up. But now I've actually got, I've cut a few holes in walls, which, by the way, like I mentioned to him, it's not scary cutting holes in sheetrock. Like if you've never done it, patching, it's really not that bad.
Right.
You can be really bad at it and try it 12 times in a row if you want. It's not going to hurt anything. So I'm not scared of that stuff. It's really just trying to figure out how to get it through joists and stuff and all that.
Yeah. I was going to say, to be fair, when you said that you're like routing cables or whatever, or like rooms or whatever, like, it almost made it sound like you're just drawing it out like, okay, this is where we're going to put that. But like, I wanted to be fair that no, you're actually like, you've made holes in floors and everything. Yes. Like you're like, you mean like cable runs are happening.
Yes, cable runs. Not just visually. Like, so I've gone up in my attic and looked over into the abyss and I found where I need wires to come from. And I've mapped that out in terms of the floor plan and what walls that comes up through and all that kind of stuff. So, and oh man, there was a tool I bought. I'll have to share it. I can't think of the name of it. Actually, it's probably right behind me in this mess of a room I have. Hold on. It's this thing. Oh, it is called, it's called a Teslong.
And oh, for testing the cable length?
No. It's actually a little camera that you can fish into the wall.
Yep.
And it's a 15 footer. But what's so sweet about this particular thing is it's got a screen that comes with it. So it's not one of these ones that you hook up to your iPhone or anything, which those are really irritating, by the way.
That's what I have
one of those. Yeah, they're really annoying. But this one, the wire hooks into the device and stays there. Like, it's not going to come out. So if you're doing things, it's not going to pop out on you. And on top of it, it'll record in, I think, 720p on this thing. Huh. But what's even cooler, it has a button. It's got a sideways camera, too. So it's got a front-facing camera and a side one. So if you're in the wall, you can hit the button and see what's beside it. So this thing has actually been extremely useful for looking at, okay, is there duct work in this hole that I made? Is there, you know, what, like, another thing, if you don't know about what's inside a lot of walls, depending on when your house is made and what floor you're on and all that kind of stuff, the wall is probably just empty space in between studs, right? So left and right, you have interior a vertical walls. Stud, interior walls, exterior walls, totally different story. But interior walls usually is just a bunch of space in between two different or two wood posts that are going vertical. However, if you're on a bottom floor, a lot of times they'll put a horizontal 2x4 or something in there to stop fire from going up faster, right? So it's basically a fire retardant. So you can pop one of these things in a wall. Like, you could even poke a little hole that you could spackle up real easy, pop this thing into the wall, take a look and see if there's anything in there or not, right? So this thing's been super handy. I think it was $100. Like, it was well worth the price.
There's a YouTube channel that I'm pretty sure that we've talked about. I could go back and find it, but because I think I talked about the what were they called? The Wagyu connectors. Is that what they were called?
Oh, yeah.
We did talk about it. And it was that guy's channel that there was a YouTuber that, like, DIYer that had turned me onto it. But he also turned me on to the idea of using something like a Dremel to cut your sheetrock so that when you do want to make a hole, like, you could make these perfectly squared off holes with super clean cuts so that when it comes time to put it back together, it's not a mess. Because, like, back in the day, I would have, like, a handsaw and I would try to cut it and it would never come out right, or I would also try, like, to, in an effort to get a cleaner cut, I would try using a razor, like those knives, the knives that have a razor as the blade
type thing.
Yeah. But, well, a little bit more heavier duty than just a box cutter, but yes. But to, in an effort to try to get, like, a super clean cut, but it was just always such a pain. And then I don't know why, I guess I was just being cheap. And then this guy, you know, I saw his video on it and had the super clean cuts that he made. And I'm like, what? Why have I been denying myself this all my life? And so, yeah, that's how I make my cuts now.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually not scary. Like, if you've never done it, it's not terrible getting in your walls. I mean, yeah, sure, you may not want to just go poking holes in your walls if you can repair them, but they're really not bad. And then the other thing I was telling Outlaw about, like, one of the holes I made was in my bathroom closet, right? Like, I don't even care. But the beauty is that's sort of the common wall between my bottom floor, my main floor, and my upper floor. And so it was a perfect place to cut a hole. Well, I didn't really want to have to deal with repairing sheetrock and stuff in there. They actually make these panels that have a spring and a clip on the back of it. So you can cut a hole in the wall. So I cut, like, a pretty decent size hole, like a 12x12. And then I can just slide this panel into place. And if you paint it, it'll just look like part of the wall. And if you ever need to get in there and do anything with the cables ever again, you just pop the thing off and you're good.
I need to see a picture of this thing. Cause you've tried to describe this to me and I'm like, it's not getting through.
Yep. I will share a link to it on Home Depot. I want to say it's like $13, $14. Like, they're cheap. Like, they're super cheap and hyper useful. So at any rate, all that to say, I am to the stage now where I'm actually taking next week off and I'm going to be doing all kinds of stuff around my house. So I'll probably be cutting holes and running wires and all that.
Another trick that I've seen people do though too is, like, take the baseboards off, and then that way, like, any holes or anything that you want to put there, you don't necessarily have to, like, redo the sheetrock. You just put the baseboard back and then done.
Yeah, man, that's a pain. Honestly, I'll tell you this. Like, I would rather cut holes in sheetrock and patch sheetrock than cut caulking on baseboards and fix all the caulking and get all that back. Because then you got to repaint. Like, seriously, the sheetrock is less time in the end.
Yeah, I have one of those little camera attachments that you were talking about too, but for that you would attach to your phone.
Yeah.
And the one I have was specifically, I could only use on my Android phone at the time, just because of the connection type. And, but it was super helpful. Like, you know, I did some cable runs in the house like that too. And another thing that I did to extend mine is like, if you ever seen, there's like fish poles, like not yes, fish tape, some. But yes. fish poles where you There's can sticks. Like screw in another pole to like yep. get the length. So, I have used those before where like I could tape the camera to like one end. And then that way I could just use the fish tape to push it or the fish sticks.
Same
to
thing
push
what it I did. Same thing I did. Yeah. And you have to do that in order to keep your camera orientation, right? Otherwise the thing's spinning all over the place.
Yeah. You don't know. Like in the movies, they just make it look like, oh, you can just point the camera up and then you just yeah. bend it. And you're like,
yeah,
no, that's not how this works. Like I don't have government spine. Money.
Yeah, the people looking at people on the other side of the door is like, no, man, it's actually way more of a pain than that. Like, man, I twisted it. It's wrong. I can't see anything.
Yeah.
So I may make some videos on this. Like, it's always that balance of, do I want to just get this done or do I want to have to get cameras set up and be like, hey, I'm breathing in a bunch of sheetrock dust right now. Here's what I've done, you know?
Yeah.
So I don't know. Yeah. I don't know what I'm going to do, but at any rate, yes, it's going to be moving along here pretty soon. All right. So yeah, now I guess the on Boomer to the real hour? Topics. Yeah. Oh. No, not Boomer Hour. We're going to save that for a minute.
Okay.
I'm sure I've got things on Boomer Hour. I'll probably,
I got some Boomer Hour topics coming. So just wait for it.
All right. So this first one came up, because we saw something happen. So we've talked about the fact that we even want to talk about Flink on some upcoming episodes, right? So we've bought the books, we've been reading them, we've been working in Flink as well. And if you have no idea what Flink is, we're talking about Apache Flink, and it is a data streaming platform for getting like real-time analytics and data processing, all that kind of stuff, all right? So here's the big deal. If you're working in a streaming platform, everything has to be fast. Everything... You didn't like it in the other ear?
No, it's not worth explaining.
Everything has to be fast, right? Like if you have millions of events coming in a minute, let's say, anything that you're doing slightly wrong in your code is a super potential bad bottleneck, right? And one of the reasons why people use Flink, man, and I was actually hoping, I did not get approved for the speaking in Oslo, by the way.
Oh, really?
My guess is AI is all the new rage. So I wouldn't be surprised if that's a lot of it and they're going to be bringing a lot of people in for that. But anyways, one of the things I wanted to talk about is why would somebody choose Apache Flink over something like Azure Functions or Google Functions or any of those, right? Because those seem like those sort of do the same type thing, right? Like you can hook them up to a PubSub or some sort of event queue and have them do things. Well, where Flink is really good is you can store state in it. Whereas like functions like Cloud Functions are typically stateless. That's the whole point of them, right? Like you give it something and it can process it and then move on. Well, the state that's important in Flink is you can kind of do whatever you want with it, right? So let's say that you have a customer and you want to track how many customer orders or their average order value or something, right? You can have that stored in Flink state as it's coming through, and you can constantly update that thing on the fly. So you don't even have to push it into an analytics engine or anything like that. Well, if you do that, let's say that you create this state and you want to be able to look up an order information by that, and you put this into a list, that might end up being a really big problem if you have a customer that has 1,000 orders or maybe 50,000 orders, right? Like you have one of the top purchasers on Amazon rolling through there. And
I don't like to brag, but yeah.
Outlaws like friends with the local Amazon delivery folks. But the problem is every single record that comes through for that customer now, if it's having to look up a particular thing, it may have to scan 50,000 records, right? And that can take a super long time. And this is why I wanted to bring up data structures, right? Like we haven't talked about this in quite some time. You know, you have your regular ints and strings and all that kind of stuff. But when you start getting into how you're storing data, there's a big difference between a list and a map. right? Like it used to be back in the day with C Sharp, you'd have hash maps and things like that, but they didn't support generics. So then they came out with dictionaries. And in Java, I think it's actually just called a map, right? I know in Kotlin it's called a map. I can't remember what it's called
map
in Java.
Yeah, being demutable maps, hash map. Hash maps is I think a hash map is actually also an interface, but mutable map is usually what I do.
Okay. So the big difference is if you're trying to get to something and there is a known key, don't use a list. Use a map of some sort, because there's usually an O of one lookup to get to that value, right? Like it knows exactly where to go to find it. Whereas if you have something in a list, there's not a lookup for it. It's going to have to scan the contents of that thing until it finds it. And then hopefully you did something good enough to just move on after you found it, right? Like you did a return or a break out of some sort of loop or something. But that, I mean, even I think this is where we as developers sort of get, we have blinders on when we're doing things. Because you might do something in a list because you're used to working with lists, and there's a find function in it, right? Or there's a contains function in it. And so you just run that thing and you're like, oh, it's good. But behind the scenes, you don't know that it's actually doing a scan of the entire thing. And so you end up taking a byte out of whatever it is. It's a really bad byte and it takes a long time. So for instance, in this one case, we found where a list was being used where a map should have been used, and changing it out changed the throughput by 60x. Like that's not a small chunk, right? Like that's a really big difference in performance. So it's easy to forget about the basic stuff as we develop. So I just wanted to bring that up as a reminder.
Yeah.
You know,
we talked, in detail about a lot of the, well, first we've done a bunch of episodes just on data structures period, but specifically during the Designing Data Intensive Applications book, series, there was a set of, episodes that were just on data structures. And also too, like another, like dusting some cobwebs off of a resource from the past, the Big O cheat sheet has a graph of the common data structure operations and like which ones, you know, like what's the average and worst case in terms of like time complexity or space complexity for some things like a hash table or an array or a queue or whatever. So I threw those out there just as like, you know, reminders in the show notes that, you know, hey, these were things from the past, like, but still very relevant, you know? So.
Yeah. Good stuff.
You know, one of my favorite things from those old ones, I don't know if you remember, I don't know if it was you or Jay-Z that found this application on phones that visualized all the Big O things and the different sorts and algorithms that were out there. It is super cool. I still have it on my phone.
Yeah, what was it? Do you remember what it's called?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember it too. I remember there was a programming app that we talked about at one point, and you could see some things, but some of the features were behind a paywall. But I don't think that's what you're talking about.
No. I'm going to have to find it. Maybe it's not on my phone now because I'm on my 12th phone since that episode, you know, 8 years ago or whatever. But I'll have to find it, but it was really cool.
Well, that was the surprising thing too, going back into like looking at data structure. Some of those episodes were like double digit episodes and I'm like, huh. But also a lot of the data intensive applications, like that covered a whole swath of episode numbers. It was like,
that was like a year of content. Yeah, for sure. And in real man hours,
it might've been more, but yeah,
probably. Like, yeah. All right. So, That one was interesting. And again, you know, if you're not even familiar with all the kinds of data structures and the sorting algorithms and all that kind of stuff, you know, probably go listen to those episodes and get familiar with it. All right. So the next one that I had that I thought was kind of interesting, this was something that came up, is if you are, let's say, I mean, we've talked about the hammer and nail situation before where people will use relational databases for that, right? Like it becomes your search engine. It becomes your analytics engine. It becomes your, you know, web front end. It's everything, right? Well, there are people that go the other direction and they'll use something like a document database for all that kind of stuff, or they'll use something like Elasticsearch or Lucene to, for their source of truth, right? Well, there was an interesting thing that came up. Microsoft is notorious for this. You guys remember when they came out with .NET 1 because they were going to brand it as like the brand new instead of .NET.
Oh yeah, that was terrible.
Yeah, so they went from .NET Core to .NET 1 and then everybody hated it. So they were like, "All right, we'll just call it .NET Core 4 whatever." I don't even remember what the direction was, but it was something whack like that. Well, when you do things like that, if you're storing your data in a place like Mongo or in a place like Elasticsearch, you don't have a lookup table for these things, right? So if you want all your data to go from .NET 1 to now .NET Core, what do? Do you go find every place in Elasticsearch that had that field and try and update it? Do you go into every collection in Mongo and try and find every single field that your application ever wrote to that had that in there?
That's
or do you make an application layer type change that will map that for you and display it differently for you on in the UI type thing, right? So behind the scenes, it's all still saved as .NET 1, but when you show it in the UI, you're doing some sort of mapping lookup that says .NET Core. Like, how would you think, what would be you guys' approach to this type problem? Or maybe Outlaw is looking kind of squinty, like maybe he doesn't understand what
I'm saying. Yeah, I think I misunderstood something because I'm trying.
Okay, so again, if you have, .NET had first named their thing .NET 1. Mm-hmm. If you put that into a billion Elasticsearch documents in multiple fields, right? And it all says .NET 1. How are you going to display that in the UI now? What are you going to do? Are you going to go update your entire index with all the fields, or are you going to try and make some sort of mapping application tier change?
That's where I got lost. I thought you were talking about like if you had these different language frameworks and you're like, hey, I want to be able to write my code in one, but but behind the scenes it could compile into the other, and I'm like,
no.
Wow, we're getting deep. Like no, this is
yep. The name.
It's basically figuring out that you should have had a primary key, or you have somewhere where you didn't, but you should have had a separation between like a logical identity and like a human readable value.
Right. And that's really what it is. But that also sort of, I mean, so that's interesting, Jay-Z, for this reason. That makes sense, especially when you think in relational thoughts, right? Like you're going to have a lookup table that has this primary key on it that is, you know, hey, .NET 1 is ABC123. However, when you're working in like a Mongo in a document database or in a place like Elasticsearch, typically you write the data straight out there. You denormalize all of it because that's how it's more efficient, right?
Right.
So did you do anything wrong? Probably not. But how would you fix it? Like, what would you do to go forward at this point?
It's so hard. Like if you were in like a Postgres or a relational database, like then there's like a kind of a clear path forward. It's like, okay, well I need to write a query to insert a new column and, you know, update the data with a new key and point it to a new table, and it's going to stink and it's probably going to take an hour for me to like write it and test it. But if you're dealing with like search engines, Mongo's, document storage, like that sort of stuff where the data is embedded, then first you have to decide if you even want to introduce some sort of primary key, because at that point you've got to do a join, and those kind of things don't do well with joins if they even support them at all. And so it's a really gross question. And right. I just don't know the answer, but I mean, I do think like if you consider like localization, like, you know, to different languages at all, then it's probably not good to store like any specific language period as your, in your actual database and reflect that directly on screen. So you obviously need some sort of lookup, but it doesn't mean that lookup has to happen in the database. So I don't know. I'm kind of torn. I kind of feel like maybe you don't try to introduce some sort of primary key if you're in that kind of NoSQL-y land.
I would kind of question the use case of like what the data is supposed to represent though. Like if the data is supposed to represent a moment in time, then you don't change the name because that's right. What the name was at that moment in time. You leave it be. And you could in your display, like, you know, show results for where the name is either. Right.
Yeah.
You know, but yeah, that it's a matter of like, well, how important is it to have the name changed in the data? Right.
Oh, geez. Yeah. That's tough. It depends. Like, I think you're totally right. So it depends on your domain and what you're doing and what's going to be worse for your users. Like there's a case to be made for keeping it separate. And you've got this difference between historical. If your domain involves like searches going back, you know, years or whatever, in older data, it's a bad user experience to kind of have people like have to remember, oh yeah, this is the old name and this is the new name. And if I want to see everything from the last year, I've got to click both.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying. Like it kind of depends on what the use case is, but you could even abstract some of that away from the user too, that where like, if they typed in a search or, you know, selected something, that you would do the search for both in the background, right? Not great. I mean, that's ugly for sure, but you know, it would also just a matter of like, well, how long are you going to keep that data around? Because is it eventually going to age out and then it's just going to correct itself? So how much time and effort do you really want to spend in trying to go back and correct that old data that you know is eventually going to age out anyways? So, you know, maybe who cares, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah. But I kind of like the idea of viewing it as a moment in time kind of snapshot. Because otherwise, why are you using like a document storage system for it if it's not supposed to represent a moment in time? Because like we've talked about this in the past with like orders, for example, like online orders. And the beauty of it is like in that one document, it could contain, here was the billing address that was used at the time the order was placed. Here's the shipping address that for that at the time, you know, did I already say billing address? I said shipping address, you know, billing information, whatever. But like all of that is that specific moment in time being represented. So not to say that you couldn't do these in relational too, but whatever.
But yeah. It's interesting though. Why would you do it in the document database? Because again, that's what, if somebody picks Mongo, that's probably their central data store, right? Or if somebody, that's kind of what stinks about it, is it's kind of hard to say, why would you do that? Because I mean, the inverse of it, right? Like people do these types of things in a relational database that are more snapshot in time things that don't work well there.
Well, I mean, part of the problem though, that I think that you're describing is that and everyone in every industry, every technology, like is probably guilty of this to some degree, where like, if that's the devil, you know, then you're going to use it more often than you probably should. Right? Like it's not that you're trying to solve like that one problem. It's just like, that's the thing, you know, you're going to use it for everything because that's what you're comfortable with, you know?
Right.
So, yeah.
Just don't do it. Just don't rename it.
Right. If only everything was that easy, like I'll just move forward. Right.
Yeah.
Roll forward.
Yeah. So, what you got? There's breaking news.
Breaking news. So yeah, if you remember last week, I was talking about keyboards and stuff, and I ended up getting one that I don't love it. I didn't realize it's 75 key keyboard, and it doesn't have the tilde button.
75? I've never even heard
75%. Sorry.
Oh, 75%.
I think it might be 67 keys. Yeah.
Okay.
So 75%, and it doesn't have the function keys, which I was like, yeah, okay, that's fine. But yeah, it doesn't have the tilde or like the back tick, which I use all the time. Depending on the language, but also I mostly just use it in Markdown for like code. So the way you have to do it is you have to hit this function key and an escape, which is terrible. And I keep hitting the wrong button. Like, so this keyboard's going back. I tried, but I was trying to decide what to do next. I was looking at maybe Newphy, Nuphy. I was kind of designing out some stuff and specking it out and just, you know, didn't love it. I was thinking about maybe getting the same keyboard. Remember, I've got that Nest keyboard, the 8-bit Do.
Yeah.
And then just tonight, as we were recording, Micro G sent me a link 8-bit Doe, I guess that's the name, 8-bit Doe, is putting out a new keyboard, very similar to the one, like almost identical to the one I have now, but based on the Commodore 64.
Yeah. So
it's got that like rainbow logo.
Yep.
Yeah, it's available for pre-order, and I pre-ordered it instantly. Even before I responded back, I was like, pre-ordered, thank you. That's it.
It definitely has that little bit of nostalgia, and it comes with the joystick.
Yeah, I am never going to use that joystick, I'll tell you right now.
I don't know. I'm waiting for your next Git commit that you typed in with just a joystick.
Yeah. It comes with the A, B buttons like the NES one does for some reason. They're just like, yeah, what the heck?
Yeah, I don't know.
I'm not using that either.
I still like that Cloud 9 that we talked about last time.
Wrong direction.
What?
You're moving the wrong direction in history. You got to go back.
You got to go backwards in time.
Yeah.
I go back in time.
Well, that would be new for me, so it would be forward. Like getting another Kinesis would be backwards, right? Unless there was like something major. I don't know if they've made any new changes to the gaming. What is this thing? The gaming freestyle RGB, bunch of letters, USB, data port, ABC, 1, 2, 3. And it's pretty good though.
Yeah.
This keyboard has
Does it have the Commodore logo though.
The amazing thing about this keyboard though is it has all the letters.
Yeah. Does it have a tilde?
It does.
All right. It's better than the Unzi I got. I can't deal with it.
Yeah. Well, all right. So how about if we were to say, like, you feel like leaving a star? Like, leave us what a star.
Who?
Oh, I forgot about that portion of the show last time, too. Like, seriously? Can't leave you guys alone.
maybe this time just leave 5 stars for Alan. You know, actually, I just wrote a review today for another podcast I'll tell you about in a little bit here. A little preview there. And it was really easy, actually. And the iPhone, like, it's been a long time since I've, you know, had an iPhone and then also did a review. So you actually could just do the stars there. You don't even have to write one, but of course, you should write one. So I did the stars and I did write a review and it took like 30 seconds and I left it. And it was great. And I'll tell you about that show here in a minute. But you could hook us up like that if you are on an iPhone. Android's got similar type stuff. We got a bunch of links on the review page, which we've got a link in the show notes. But if you also just remember codingblocks.net/review.
What if we went maybe viral, though, for 1-star reviews?
No. No. No, how about not what if? Yeah. We're not one of those shows. Like, you know, there's those people on various different platforms that like just rub people wrong. And so they get tons of views. We're not those guys. Like, we're not trying to be those guys.
Okay.
Yeah. Anti-heroes.
Are you saying we are not controversial?
Probably not most of the time.
Let me talk to you about sorting.
Spaces.
Let me talk to you about sorting.
Did you just pull a Swiftie on us there, Jay-Z? I think you did.
A Swiftie?
You called us an anti-hero. Isn't that one of the popular songs? I think you did.
Yeah. See, and you out-tayed me. Good job.
My mind immediately went to like Deadpool. So, yeah.
Oh, man, I started watching that again the other night. That movie's so fun.
Can't wait. Part 3 coming out. The dramatic conclusion to the story.
That's sad.
sad. okay, so, well, hey, we haven't done this in a while, so how about it's time for Mental Blocks. Bum, bum, bum.
This should be interesting.
Yeah, how do we do this again?
Yeah,
all right, this is 231, so according to the Tuckho's trademark rules of engagement, Alan is first.
I have the advantage.
Yep.
Maybe
the categories are As Seen on Shark Tank. And Alan, that's a TV show.
I've seen that show.
Oh.
I've seen them all. I'm ready. This wonderful hashtag. Barbara. Hashtag Team Barbara.
The next, Woulda, Coulda, Shoulda. Man, I don't even know how I'm supposed to pronounce this one. This isn't even a proper noun, is it? Demonyms. Demonyms are words that refer to a native or a resident of a certain place. Mm. Next category. What? Oh, that's rich. lesser known siblings, and lastly, all you need is love, L-O-V-E. These are words that can be made entirely from the letters in L-O-V-E. You could use them more than once if need be.
All right. Let's do the L-O-V-E for 500.
Wow. We're coming out of the gate strong.
Five. Yeah, let's do it.
As Charles Darwin could tell you, to do this is to gradually change or develop over time.
What is evolve?
That is correct. Dang. Yeah. Yeah. So I'm sorry, Joe. You probably already lost.
Yeah, that was good. Why can't I get Shark Tank?
All right. So, I'll give you a Shark Tank one just to make you feel better before I break your spirits. So how about a 300 one?
Sounds good.
This company with a bumblebee inspired name has the highest lifetime sales in shark history. That's a lot of socks.
I don't know.
And this is why I'm breaking your spirits. Bombas.
Yeah.
Is the answer.
Oh, Bombas. They actually give money for every pair you buy.
They donate a pair of socks.
Yeah.
All right. So. Here you go, Joe.
All right.
Dang it.
This first category is not meant as a slight, by the way. Feeling gassy? Right. Oh. Fictional TV towns. Big dogs as little puppies. You'll be seeing... Oh, this one's a visual. You'll be seeing some very large breeds when they were very cute puppies. We're not going to do that one.
That one.
Yeah. Well, I said no. For sweater... Or worse, Wine Biz and Merriam-Webster's Words of the Year.
I gotta say I'm feeling a little gassy.
I was really hoping that you'd pick the Words of the Year one. All right, what's your cat? What's your what level we got?
I would have been smarter. I don't know. Let's go with two more than Alan got.
That's not an option.
That's a lot of gas, son.
It's 500, right? I forget what the denominations
it's
are.
It's 1 through 5, man.
We just do the 1 through 5. This is mental blocks. I think you're confusing it with another show. Okay, yeah, sorry, so you're going mark. 5. Helium gas gets its name from the Greek word for this astronomical body where it was first detected.
Whoa.
Do I get to steal? If he doesn't know it.
Well, you gotta wait. I mean,
Helios is sun, right? Isn't it? Was first detected?
Yeah. What's your answer?
We didn't first detect the sun.
Is that your answer?
Yeah, I mean, I'm just going to say sun.
That is correct.
Okay.
We got a tie game, gentlemen. Here we go.
All right.
Alan, your categories are EZ, geography. The consecutive letters E and Z will appear in each correct response. You're a homophone, Diane. Hi, I'm J-Lo. Shapes in nature, fashion for all. And lastly, pew, pew, pew. The sound will begin each correct response.
Ooh, I like that one. Sound. Sound okay. For okay. 3.
For 3. Henry David Thoreau pondered why a bucket of water becomes this foul word, but frozen remains sweet forever.
Say that one more time.
Henry David Thoreau pondered why a bucket of water becomes this foul word, but frozen remains sweet forever. And the but sweet forever. But frozen remains sweet forever is in quotes.
I don't know.
Jay-Z for the still.
Can you say it one more time?
It's not going to get any easier. Henry David Thoreau. This is Alan's fault, by the way. Henry David Thoreau pondered why a bucket of water becomes this foul word. but Frozen remains sweet forever.
I mean, it's ice, right? What is ice?
That is wrong. The correct answer is putrid.
Putrid.
What?
I didn't pick the category, Alan. That was so confused.
I mean, that's why they call them mental blocks, folks.
Yeah, I got nothing, man.
Yeah. I mean, there were so many better ones, like, you know, like, yeah, fashion, J-Lo, geography. Come on. You don't know geography? I don't. I would have gotten that one wrong. All right, here we go. We're a tie game. Category is rallying cries. You ready? Yep. Each of you need to find a place to, let's see, how we want to do this.
All of it. It's fun.
Yeah. But you gotta write out what your vote is going to be and write your answer somewhere where the other person can't see it.
Right. I'm going to go to sheet five.
I was going to say, why don't you like privately send me a message of where your answer is? Just privately send me the answer as a
too easy.
Yeah.
That's too easy. Yeah, what you do? All right. That's fine.
That way, in the spirit of fairness,
let's do it.
Yeah. Here we go. Rallying cries. Don't mess with Texas. Sam Houston's troops shouted this three-word battle cry while attacking Santa Anna's army at San... I'm thinking that's supposed to be Juanito, but it looks more like Juancito. So I guess Juanito has to be wrong. So I'm messing you up. S-A-N-J-A-C-I-N-T-O. I don't know.
Three-word battle cry.
Yeah. I mean, now that part, like, who cares about the San Jacinto part? Like, that, you should already know this. If you don't know it, I'm ashamed of you.
Can we go over a word? Is that okay?
Yeah, if that's how you count to three, whatever it takes to get the job done. You know, three, four. I got an answer from Joe, but I don't have the amount you're wagering. You need to put that in there.
I mean, I thought that was obvious.
Yeah, it was all in for all of us.
I think Alan's Google searching.
No. Okay, there we go.
All right. So let's see here. Alan wagered five. He was all in. And his answer is, I don't know. So let me go ahead and enter this score in as the Texas battle cry. I don't know!
Was that correct? Please say yes.
And that is not correct. So Alan has 0 points on the score. Scoreboard here.
Started off so strong.
Joe, however, I'm going to go ahead and just tell you, he got it right. So he wins. Remember the Alamo.
Oh, man.
You know, I kept thinking, don't forget the Alamo. And I was like, there's got to be another word for don't forget.
Man, I haven't heard that in so long.
Don't forget.
So good.
Yeah, man.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Yes.
Yeah, so, you know how I know that, by the way? The only reason I even know that is just from Pee Wee Herman.
Oh, wow.
Pee Wee's really? Big Adventure. Yeah, I've seen that movie a million times.
I guess, is it just me? I remember it from history class. Like, isn't that?
No.
No?
Why would you talk about that in history? No.
I don't know, because it was like part of history, you know, stuff that you learned. We used to learn. All right, well. We're done with mental blocks. Joe just trounced Alan. Like it was brutal bloodbath. We asked for a star. Now my topic for the show, for the water cooler, comments. So more specifically, I saw this recent picture and I just found it so hilarious. This was in Programmer Humor. on Reddit, and it was called Junior Devs Writing Comments. And I'm going to throw a link out here for you guys to see it if you haven't seen it already. And it just pretty much sums up how some comments are just awful, where there's a stop sign and then below it is another sign pointing to that stop sign that says this is a stop sign. Man. And the frustration that I had, that the reason why the timing of when I saw this, of like when this happened, like, cause this is the thread in on Reddit that I'm sending to is kind of old, but, this picture was recently floating around again, and the timing of it coming up was so perfect for what I was working on that I was just like, man, I think that person works at Google, because I'm going to send you this. Okay. So also in there, check out this as an example. If you go look at the comments for the properties on this thing and tell me that person did not write the comment for that sign. So I've been working lately on, with the Google Cloud Functions library, and it is ridiculous. I have grown to hate automated documentation.
Yes.
Because if you're not going to take the time to put the proper comments in your code so that the automation creates good quality, you know, output, then what's the point of it to begin with? And the Google Cloud Function library, the specific link that I pointed them to is for Node.js, but this is pretty consistent with what I saw in their reference documentation, regardless of language. So Java, .NET, whatever, didn't matter. Go, Rust, it was all pretty much like this, to where it would have like a property called name, and the comment from Google is, this is it, literally the just two words, get operation request name, where get operation request is the name of the object, right? So yeah. And I'm like, yeah, I know that from the name of the property. Like, that's not helped me. Like, there are better examples where, like, this one is just like kind of easy to point to as like an egregious example of where the comments don't help. But within this library and the functions and then the object types and everything, there's so many examples where the automated documentation just really falls flat. Like the description of whatever the class or interface or whatever property it is, or the method, like it really doesn't go much further than describing what the thing are, what it was already named to begin with. And then to add on to that, there are, like, I'll send you another example here. Actually, let me get a better. Well, maybe we can get one that corresponds with that. Yeah, here we go. So check this out. So here's the corresponding, cause I gave you, yeah, get operation. Yeah. So here's the corresponding, that was the interface, or no, that was the class that I gave you to construct that. Here's the documentation for the actual method that would use that request. And you could tell that, like, the descriptions, I think, are also like generated too, because the description of the method is describing the return value, and it says promise. The promise which resolves to an array, the first element of the array is an object representing space, period. You're like,
that's ridiculous.
Representing what? What is it representing? I want to know. You know, but also too, the most frustrating thing about this documentation was that, like, there was automatically, at least they warn you that the snippet has been automatically generated. So there's like automatically generated code examples of, like, hey, here's how you would call this thing. But it really is just like class.method name with like a request put in as the parameter. But so you're like, okay, well, what does the request object need to look like? And every time it's just like request equals object, you know, like in JavaScript, you know, like just curly braces. And you're like, yeah, but what are the properties? So you have to go digging through it. So it took, the frustrating part was, I eventually got to the point where I, like, could, you know, navigate my way through and figure out, like, okay, I know what they're trying to say here. and could figure out what the request was supposed to look like. Hence, I sent you an example of that. But it was just so frustrating getting started with this documentation and these poorly automatically generated examples that were like kind of worthless. Like it didn't really help. Yeah. So
this is actually the intro to Boomer Hour, because I can actually piggyback on this, because honestly, like we've talked about how incredibly good Microsoft's documentation is.
Yeah.
Like
industry leading,
bar none. It is the best, hands down. They have examples on the page, like real legit examples. I ran into something very similar to this recently, Outlaw, where I was having to update something on some GCP thing. I don't remember if it was a pub sub queue or something. I don't even remember, but it was a similar type thing where the documentation was just abysmal. And when I, even with the sample code they had there, I kind of took it up there and modified it and went to run it, and it'd fail. And he'd be like, "Oh, you didn't pass a mask." And I'm like, "A field mask? What are you talking about? Like, I don't even know what you're talking about." So I go look, and I'm like, "Oh, okay. So I need to tell it what field I want to update in this thing. Okay. Well, where's the lookup values for what these fields actually are?" Nowhere. Couldn't find them anywhere. I searched all over the place, man. Like everywhere. I looked through the Python docs, the Java docs. I looked through everything. Couldn't find it. And I got really irritated because my code was done in 20 minutes, but I couldn't get it to work for hours because I couldn't find the information. So what I ended up doing was debugging, sending a request, debugging all the way into their gRPC call so I could see what kind of masks it was passing so that I could rip those values out and borrow them for my update method. And I got it to work. I shouldn't have to do that. I should not have to debug down into their low level code, their client, to be able to find that. Dude, I was so mad. And the thing is, like, part of me wants to be a good Samaritan and go, you know, to the page where it's like, "Hey, can we improve this?" And I'll be like, "Yes."
Yeah.
But then I'm like, man, I don't have the energy to write up this 5 paragraphs of what I just went through to tell them that this is inadequate, because they should have known it was inadequate, right? Yeah. All right. Done. Ooh. Boomer Hour. I'm
done. Yeah. Another one of the frustrating things, though, about this, this kind of like caught my eye, and I was like, "Oh, sweet. They did this." And then I was like really burnt when I saw how it was implemented. So like, if you're ever poking around within like the Google Cloud, you know, tooling, right? Like the different pages for it. I haven't noticed a dark mode for it, but like some websites like GitHub, for example, you know, you can go into your profile, say like, "I want the dark mode." Well, so I was poking around, you know, going through this documentation, and I saw the little vertical ellipse, and I'm like, "Oh, dark mode. Yeah, I want that." But it was only for the code.
Yes.
Example, it was
not the page.
Like, yeah.
I'm like, yeah, it's terrible.
Somebody wasted developer time, right, implementing this feature just for that one little bit of thing. Like, really?
So now your eyes are bleeding all around the edges.
Yes.
like where you're looking.
I was so disappointed. And by the way, so that's not to say that there isn't like, cause like at the language level, there are some other, you know, examples of good documentation out there, you know, like we've talked about the Kotlin resources, yeah, before.
Amazing. Yeah.
You know, as being really good. So I guess I'm thinking more of like, skip the language level and let's talk about libraries. And that's where like Microsoft just seems to kill it in that regard.
Yeah. The best by far.
Yeah. Java docs absolutely make me want to burn the world down. Like, yep. I can't deal with them.
Yeah. Worst idea ever. Like, it's not that it's the worst idea. It's just poorly implemented. Like, so often is the case where it's just like the documentation is never the focus. It's never the, and you know, like nobody cares. Like, it's always the last thing that's thought of. And maybe that's why, like, I guess you know, going back into the 80s, you know, you like you watch documentaries and whatnot, and like catering to the developer was something that, at least from things that I've read and seen, that seemed to be like where Microsoft put their emphasis, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it shows in yep. things like that.
So polished.
Yeah.
Yeah, this kind of stuff really does irk me. Like it makes me mad, like physically angry sometimes. All right.
So, yeah. All right. Well, that was my short little boomer minute.
Hey, wait, Jay-Z looked like he was going to chip in. I just had a boomer
confession, actually. Unfortunately, I went to share the keyboard that I just mentioned, the Commodore 64 remake, whatever, 8-bit, and I shared the thank you page from my pre-order rather than the actual item. I'm like, I'll just click the link, y'all. I see it when I click.
Well, I mean, for what it's worth, like when you put that link out there and I clicked it, I didn't see anything about your order. I saw the product page.
Yeah, I sent a different link. That's what you get for ordering stuff instead of paying attention to recording or ordering. I messed up everything. Ah, yeah.
So what's this dev hints that somebody put out there?
Yeah, so this was something that MicroG sent, and I don't think we talked about it last time. What I like about it is I probably should use this as a tip of the week, but whatever, it's going here. Because not only is it just a cool thing to have, so like example, you go to this website, you can search for, I would click on Bash, I don't really use the search, but you can click on like a Bash or, I don't know, Enzyme is React. Vim, they've got things for Git, Docker is in there, Docker Compose. It's basically like just a huge collection. Emacs is in there, a collection of cheat sheets for various tools. So there's been times when you're given tips for like, you know, the Docker cheat sheet or something. And this is actually just a collection of a bunch. So you can bookmark this one thing and go in here and you can see there's a ton of them. Like, I guess that's why they have the search. And so I'm just going to go into Docker. And what I thought was really cool about this, and was, you know, it sounds kind of dumb, or Docker file will do. Each cheat sheet isn't really forced into a common interface in the way that a lot of tools like this will do. Like we talked about like man pages before, and like you look at the man page, it's got a very similar structure between different tools, but a lot of times these tools just do things in a different way. And it doesn't always make sense to try and kind of force them into the same kind of format. If you think like about a Git, for example, Git has a bunch of like sub programs. So you can do Git add or Git remove or Git commit. And, you know, kubectl is the same way, but something like curl has a bunch of flags. So, you know, dash L, dash ash, follow, whatever. And so I like that each of these cheat sheets is really catered to how it's used. And so like you can look at a cheat sheet for bash and one for git, and it's going to look totally different. And I don't know if that was a good example. Hopefully it was, but like I'm looking for Ansible, and it's got little, you know, tabs, and you can kind of break it down, and it's just really well thought out. And it's got nice links. And so it's kind of like a nice one-stop shop to have all your cheat sheets. And I just thought it was kind of a nice user interface for something that's complicated.
You want to know a secret though?
Yeah.
It's a good thing you didn't use this as your tip of the week.
Oh, yeah? Is it your tip of the week?
Well, no.
Did you already do it?
But back in episode 86.
No.
Wow. It was our tip of the week. One of our tips
of the week. This one
was? Rico's Cheat Sheets, devhints.io.
Oh, my gosh, Michael G, failed me. Wow.
Okay, no, well. I don't know that it's a fail as much as it's just like, well, we're consistent.
Yeah, still a legit tool.
Yeah.
All right, you're good.
So.
Well, dang. Well, there's my good thing it wasn't a tip.
Yeah. Yeah, there you go.
All right, well, I have one more for you. Okay. Also not a tip. So saw an article come up on Reddit programming, and it was on Hacker News briefly today about data scientist salaries. And there's nothing really it's like super crazy interesting in here other than I like the way that they kind of broke down the analysis for like salary. And what they did is they, it's a data scientist who put this together. So they took some data from a Kaggle survey. So already survey data, you know, put a star on it. But they sliced it up a couple different ways. And they looked at the what they figured out to be the six most important indicators of your salary for a data scientist. And then they ranked them, and they talked about like how those kind of ranks interplay and anything and everything. And I just thought it was a kind of cool way of looking at the problem, and I like the data first approach. I thought it'd be cool to kind of talk about what those, I thought it was six factors broke.
Know how you count the three. So
dang it. Yeah, it's true. So there's five factors. I was wrong about the five factors. And there's nothing groundbreaking here. There's no like, you know, crazy, what you call it, you know, there's no like catch here. It's just kind of cool to see that, you know, country was number one. So obviously there's people in a high cost of living country and people in a lower cost of living country. There's a big difference in salary, and that is going to account for more than like the second part, which is your industry. I did think it was interesting that that industry was in there so high. I would have guessed that years of seniority or experience or something like that would have been like the second most influential factor on your salary. But actually they said industry. So if you like work in the healthcare or oil industry or agriculture, whatever, that makes a bigger impact apparently on your salary than your number of years working, as a data scientist anyway. Well, it's something to think about. Like if you are sometimes wondering like, hey, that's weird. It seems like other people with the same, you know, title as me are making more money, then it might be worth looking at your industry and considering a change or a pivot there. Third one was job title. So that kind of, you know, maps up with experience, but not quite. You know, someone with the senior title is going to get paid more than a junior, but still less influential than industry. And the article, by the way, goes into talking about just how much, you know, the difference there is and just some other kind of important tidbits that are worth reading if you're interested. Years of coding experience was next. And then years specifically about machine learning experience was under. And it was interesting to see that your years coding experience was more of a factor than your machine learning specific experience. But the whole thing I just thought was interesting. It's cool analysis. So I recommend reading an article. We'll have a link to it.
It's really good. I mean, it is broken down super like a data scientist would do it. Like it's,
yeah,
it's done super well.
If you look at country, I mean, it's like so far and above. It's like, hey, if you want to raise, like, look at moving.
Well, what's crazy is they even break it down further than that. So they took the country, and the country was a big one, right? But then they break it down by like the top 123 cities.
Yep.
And it's significant even from number one to number 10. Right. Yeah. So, I mean, the city that you live in could be the difference in almost $100,000. So, but you also have to keep in mind, right? Like, I think they have, what is it? Santa Clara is number one. San Francisco is number two. Palo Alto, number three. The cost of living in all those places is for sky sure. high. So if you were to go to, you know, a Milwaukee, which is number 15 on the list, your quality of life there, all things being considered, if you're not talking about amazing weather and all that kind of stuff, but just how far your dollar goes at number 15 is going to be way more than what you are at number one. So, you know, that's all stuff that you have to weigh into, which is really hard to make in a single chart.
Yep. Yeah. So good point. Yeah. I just thought it was cool.
Yeah. So. It's very cool.
Good stuff. And Kakaban, geez, so much good data there.
All right. Well, I guess we'll have some links then, maybe like one or 50. Depends on who's counting.
Yeah.
So with that, hey, you know, we haven't had it in a long time, or I haven't, maybe it's just me that hasn't said it, or maybe I have said it. It's the tip of the week.
Yeah.
All right. Alan's favorite portion of the show. So, hey, remember our friend Carl Schweitzer? One of the hosts of the MS Dev Show. Well, he's got a new podcast called Cloud Chat. Just started. Easily the best thing and the most valuable item I've ever gotten from LinkedIn. Happened to see an update there. I was like, yes, so I'm very excited. And I've written a review already for the show. And yeah, it's a cloud podcast talking about, you know, all sorts of clouding. And I think it's funny is that they have an episode zero kind of introducing, and they have an episode one all about the, I'm not going to say out loud because I don't want to get beeped again. But the first episode is about the AAS's of cloud computing. So like PaaS, IaaS, you know, software as a service, SaaS. So it's just kind of funny to lay it out like that. And it reads a little funny to get a little chuckle to say it out loud. So go check that show out. I know a lot of people here were big fans of the MS Dev show, you know, people listening to the show, and it was a great show. So you should go check it out, because I'm sure this is also going to be amazing.
Hey, and I actually told Carl that I was going to mention it the next time I was on the podcast, and unfortunately I missed the last episode. So I'll just pile on here with Jay-Z and be like, again, you know, go check it out. He's an awesome dude, and they definitely put out a quality show before, and I have no doubt this one will be good.
Yep. I still have my swag. I got a hat and a mug. My hat, that hat is beat. That has been to the beach like 200 times. I don't even know how many times.
That's awesome.
I got one more for you. So another music suggestion. I know, but it's so good. It's another album. This time it's from a band or a person who goes by the name of Fortet. Been making music under that name since I looked at 1999. New album. And it's, if you're not familiar, it's often described as IDM, which is a kind of controversial term, but basically people often refer to it as intelligent dance music, which I think I've even mentioned this on the show. It's just kind of an awkward title, you know, it kind of implies that other music isn't. But anyway, that's a whole other discussion, not going to get into, but it's basically slower and kind of more experimental than music you would see like at a club or something. But it's still kind of in that electro vein. It's got a steady beat, kind of like a hip hop kind of beat. And then the melodies are interesting. They almost kind of feel random sometimes. They're like there's definitely a pattern there, but it sometimes just feels like they're almost painted on with like a Photoshop brush or something. Anyway, I just think it's really cool and it helps me get in the zone. So I'll have a link to that, their new album. Again, the album, the band's name was Fortet, Fortet.
Like instead of a quartet, they're a Fortet?
Yeah.
Yes,
exactly.
All right.
With only one person.
Oh, well, that makes it weirder.
Yep.
One tet.
Yeah.
IDM.
So, man, I feel like I'm bashing on Google here. So I apologize.
Maybe.
So,
hey, remember the Google Reader. That's all I got to say. Four words, but you know.
So just generally, I'm going to say sometimes Google lies. And what I mean by that is what's been super, 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 super frustrating for me working with that Cloud Function library is that in doing things with like Kubernetes cluster management stuff, but from like, you know, using an API to do it. Right. It's kind of frustrating because you issue the request and they're like, yep, hey, here's, you know, are the promise resolved and everything. But really that doesn't necessarily mean that the thing is done. It just means that like your request went through. So you're like, okay, I get that. That's fair. Cause some of these requests could be long running things. Right. But, then you like can get the operation, use the operation name or ID to like query, hey, what's the status of this thing? Right. And it'll tell you, like in the case of turning off auto scaling, like, yep, hey, I turned it off. But what I noticed in experience is that it says it's turned off. The UI says it's turned off. But if the next operation is like, hey, scale the cluster down to zero nodes, what you see happen is if those requests happen too quick, then it's even though it says the cluster is in auto scaling is off, it'll be like, oh, well, we're scaling them down to zero. So I need to cordon off all of these nodes. But oh, because I'm auto scaling, I need to spin up this number of nodes. So you just end up moving all of your pods from one set of nodes to a new set of nodes. And it may not even be the same number of nodes because it's almost as if like you were too quick in issuing the request to resize the cluster and, or the node pool rather. And, so maybe word hadn't gotten around to everything, but why tell me that it's turned off then? Why not say the operation is still in progress? Like if it that, so yeah, sometimes they lie.
Boomer Hour Part 2.
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah, I guess it really should have been. I guess I didn't have a tip of the week. I just had Boomer Hour material.
Well, it's funny you say that about the cluster thing. So I had similar type of experiences with Dataproc. Not quite as bad, But like the Python libraries that they had for Dataproc, which is a Spark type cluster, you type things and you can do other things with it within GCP. But their library was sort of a callback thing, right? Like, so there was a promise sort of thing that would be issued. And then there was like these callbacks. And for whatever reason, the client library would just sometimes stop taking the callbacks. And then your application would be hung. And it was like, what? Like, wait a second. If I got to rely on this thing to get a response, like, it better be pretty reliable. And so I ended up having to go to like my own long polling type thing to it to be able to resolve that kind of stuff, to check on the status. Cause it's like, I mean, I want to use the SDK. The whole reason the SDK exists is to make my life easier. But when you make my life harder, now I've actually got to go do things my own way, which may or may not be good. Right. Like, I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, that I'm with you. And that was part of the frustration, because like in the cloud functions, you could provide a callback. So you could just say like, hey, when this is done, you know, let me go. Yeah. No. But just because it calls you back doesn't mean that the thing was actually done. Right. So you could still get into that trouble, but also plus the function would have, Google will have reported in, like, you could see it in the Logs Explorer. Like, it'll say, hey, your function completed.
We're done.
And then you'll see output coming back from your callback. But the scary thing is that you're not guaranteed to have those resources still available, right? Because as far as
it's Google's done
it, it killed it, right? It's done.
Yeah.
So, you know, I just by chance happened to be getting some things after in that callback. So I definitely like ended up refactoring it to not rely on the callback, but also that operation thing, like I ended up, you know, making my own, kind of like polling operation that would do like a back off strategy, not exponential, but, what's the
retry with back off?
There's a better, isn't there a better term for it though than back off? That sounds like a Yosemite Sam, like thing you'd see, like, you know, on something, like Wheeler.
What'd you say? Jizzy?
Oh yeah. I think it's a exponential back off is always what I heard for it.
Okay. Yeah. Well, so I ended up implementing something like that, to like query the operation status to see. And, but like I said, you couldn't rely that necessary, even when it would come back, you would see, I could see in the output, like it's pending, it's running, it's done. And you're like, oh, and you could even take, you could go to the command line and do like a gcloud container operation describe or something like that. I forget the exact syntax. And then you could pass in that long, operation name, and it would also report back like done, but it didn't really mean that it was done. And so, you know, the root problem that I was trying to solve was I was trying to turn off auto scaling programmatically. And I wanted to scale all the nodes in that node pool. I wanted to scale the node pool down to zero nodes to, you know, basically like in a cost saving kind of effort. But you couldn't do those things too fast, and I couldn't rely on the status coming back from the cloud function to let me know, or even the command line to let me know that, yep, it's actually done. And now it's safe to scale the node pool down to zero, because, you know, somewhere out there within the process, it still thought like, you know, there was like a scheduler somewhere that was like, oh, hey, guess what? We're still doing auto scaling.
Hey, just thinking out loud though. So functions, cloud functions, you know, whether they're in Google or Azure or whatever, I think anytime that you're dealing with callbacks, you probably want to find another way to do that to at least make it a blocking operation, right? Because like you said, if you're waiting on a callback, that implies that it's an asynchronous call and then it's going to happen sometime in the future. But once you get past that line in your function and you return out, it's like you said, Google's going to be like, hey, we're done with the function. So, you know, just think it for anybody that's working in anything like that. If you're dealing with callbacks, you almost want to force a synchronous type operation in order to get that result back.
Synchronous.
Not synchronous, not asynchronous. Yes. Right. To use.
It was almost so, it was like, cause you were like, you almost want to use asynchronous. And I'm like, wait a minute. Let's just be clear. Yeah.
The synchronous.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just.
Yeah. It's actually not a real easy problem, but.
It's not from Arian either. Like, you know, sorry, Joe, but yeah, like they definitely are solving like extremely hard problems and I'm unfairly, you know, saying that they lie, but.
But they do.
Maybe.
Right, so what were you saying, Jesse?
Yeah. I was saying like the thing that I don't like about asynchronous calls is that you always end up making them synchronous. It's such a pain and they just infect and spread like a virus throughout your code. It's like, oh, no, everything that touches this thing's got to be async until you finally end up making it asynchronous, you know, whatever. And like, I get it. It's totally better than like the callback hell, but it's just every time I say, see an async, I've got to work with them. Like, all right, here we go. let's see where we end up today.
What's beautiful.
Going on a tour.
If you start looking at like the JavaScript implementations of that stuff, if you see the asyncs and the awaits, it's basically synchronous.
Yeah.
Asynchronous calls. It's synchronously making asynchronous calls and waits and call. Yep. And it's like, okay. All right.
Lies all the way down.
Yeah, man. Yeah. And then it gets really confusing because people who don't understand it are like, wait, hold up. And every time I look at it, I got to go read the documentation again. So,
well, and in this case, the documentation is so great.
Right. Yeah, of course. Like it sets the name. Yeah. The name property sets the name. Thank you.
Did you know that? The name.
I did.
Oddly, this is not a credit card number. This is the name.
Revolutionary right there. Yeah. All right. So my tips, one of these I borrowed from one of our friends, Ryan, who we've talked about before on the show, Ryan Mosser. He was trying to figure out some Helm templating things and he found this helm-playground.com and it's actually pretty cool. I don't know how far it'll get you with actually trying to make sure that things render out properly on everything you're doing in like a deployment pipeline. However, if you want to see what like Helm templates and functions and all that kind of stuff can do and piping different things, you can go up here to this website and in the left-hand pane, put your information like a values dot, you know, my property or whatever, and then do a to YAML and an indent space 4 or whatever, and it will actually show you over on the far right. So the middle is your value.yaml, your values.yaml. On the right is the output of what your first template section is. So it's a really nice way to be able to see if you're actually creating something that should generate the proper YAML, right? So pretty neat. However, you can also do things like this on your local with a Helm. There's a command. It's a Helm template something. You remember it, Jay-Z?
Isn't it Helm template render or Helm tuple debug or something?
Yeah, but something like that. So that's actually a nice way to do it. If like we've talked about scaffold and all that, if you're trying to see how that's all going to be rendered out, you can actually do this on the command line on your local system. But this is a nice way to do it in a UI without having to have anything installed or anything like that. So pretty cool. All right. And then the next one, this one's going to be a little verbose. I'm going to try and not make it so incredibly boring, but I found some Java things recently that were super key.
It's Java and it's not going to be verbose.
Yeah. Right.
Now you've got my attention.
Well, so I'm going to try not to make it verbose. It may be impossible. So setting the background, if you've ever written a Java application and you've run it on a machine, chances are you also know that you can't just be like, hey, Java run and then my class, because ultimately what's going to happen is you're going to run into memory management issues, right? Because Java is only going to take up so much RAM that's available on the machine and all that. Like it tries to be nice. It tries to play nice with other things on the machine. So you kind of have to tell it, yo, I need 10 gigs of RAM and I need it to do this and that and this and that. So a lot of times what you'll see are Java run commands that have things like XMS and XMX for managing heap space and all that. So that's all cool. Well, when you get into the world of running in Kubernetes and containers and that type of thing, this is sort of a different world because when you're running in a container, usually you have one thing running in that container, right? Like one, it's a very specific thing. So your Java application that you wrote, like, you know, the thing that's going to make you $1 million, your $1 million Java app, it's running in that container. That container was sized. Like when you started that container up, you said, hey, I want it to have 4 gigs of RAM and so many CPUs. In that world, you kind of want whatever application's running to just use all the resources available because that's what it was made for, right? It's not like running on a machine.
Well, and Java's a special beast on Kubernetes because technically you could have a request and a limit that are different. So you could say, initially request 4 gigs of RAM, but limit it to 12 gigs.
Yes. And this is where things get especially nasty is when you do that, what he just said, one of the things that's really frustrating is the JVM by default, if I remember right, and you know, somebody might actually come back and smack me down for this, but I want to say that it'll only take 25% of the available RAM. So if you start up, and it all depends on various thresholds, how much memory is available and all that. But if you were to start up a container that had 10 gigs of RAM associated with it and you didn't give it any parameters in the Java run, it's only going to take 2.5 gigs of RAM and that's it, right? So the rest of it's just being wasted, more or less. You're paying for 7.5 gigs of RAM that's never going to get touched. So there is a cool little flag in Java that will allow it to take up all the resources available, and it is called plus use container support. So, you know, like when you have a dash D XMS or whatever, this is an XX colon plus use container support. This basically tells Java, hey, you're the only thing here. Use everything available. That's awesome, right? So if you give your container 10 gigs of RAM, Java now is going to take 10 gigs of RAM for the JVM. It's beautiful. Now, one of the things that I mentioned is you have things like XMS, which is the minimum Java heap space that you want Java to use. And there's XMX that is the maximum heap space that Java can use. The problem with these are you had to actually specify the hard value of it, right? Like, hey, I want 1 gig in my heap or I want it max of 2 gigs. Well, the problem with that is if you're resizing your container to take more RAM or whatever, well, having that hard coded value in there kind of stinks, especially when you have deployments and all that stuff go out. There's a couple more parameters that you can pass to the Java, to the JVM when it runs this thing. One is called initial RAM percentage. And there's another one called max RAM percentage. And they're just what you think they are, right? So you can say, hey, I want, and these are for the heap. These are for JVM to size the heap for you. So you can say, hey, I want the initial heap size to be 80% of the overall RAM available. So that's beautiful. If you had 10 gigs assigned to the container, 8 gigs of it are going to go to the heap.
Let's be more realistic. Maybe you wanted to say, like, you want that initial to be 40%.
Yeah.
So if your limit is the 10 gig, you're going to get 4 gig.
Right.
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 And then you're saying that max would know that, like, hey, at the time that container might only have, like, say 5 gigs of actual memory being used by the Kubernetes, by the pod, but Java would know that, like, hey, I'm going to, the limit is 10. I'm going to use 4, and then it will play nicely in the Kubernetes ecosystem.
No. So this is where things get even a little bit more squirrely. So in Kubernetes, when you deploy a pod, right, or when you define a deployment, you're going to have requests and limits, right? Mm-hmm. So your request is, hey, I want 10 gigs of RAM. However, if for some reason this container goes crazy, we're going to let it go up to 12 gigs of RAM.
Right.
Java doesn't play nice with that.
Right. So in the Java world, the recommendation has just been for Java apps, make the request equal the limit because it's correct. Not going to play nicely with changing that size.
Well, in this case, if you start using these use container support and all these other things, it doesn't even care about the request. It only uses the limit. So whatever you set the limit to,
I see what you're saying.
If you set your request to 10 and your limit at 12, when this container starts up, Java's going to be like, I want all 12 done. Right. And so this thing automatically grows to 12 gigs of RAM being used by it. And then you're moving on. However, the big thing here, and this is both good and bad. So a lot of times you'll see for apps that need large heaps and you don't want garbage collection to like constantly be resizing your heap because it can take up a lot of processing time. A lot of times what they'll tell you is to set your min and your max to the same, mm-hmm. right? Sort of like the request and limit for the container. The problem with that, and this is sort of frustrating, is when you go that route, a lot of times when you try and turn on high availability scaling in Kubernetes, it's based off resource utilization, right?
Well, okay.
Go ahead.
I got something that I was going to add to it, but let me finish your thought first. I'm sorry. I didn't.
You're good. So if you wanted to base it off memory utilization, you kind of killed it if you set this max RAM percentage and min RAM percentage to the same, because they're never going to fluctuate, right?
Well, even regardless of this initial and max RAM percentage, even if you didn't do that and you did set the request and the limit equal the same, because the Java apps, because that JVM is going to grab a set amount of memory when it starts, and it's not going to change that. And which is what I was hoping this max ramp would do, but it sounds like you're saying it doesn't do that. It's still going to only grab like a set amount. Memory is actually a bad metric to use for horizontal pod autoscaling in this regard, because if you have an app, the way the horizontal pod autoscaling is going to work is going to be based off of the average utilization of whatever that metric is. So if you spin up, let's say it was CPU, right? And you say, hey, anytime the CPU gets over 80%, spin up a second one. So you have, and there's like some thresholding, you know, like it'll wait for things to stabilize. And if it stays hot that across that metric for a period of time, then it'll spin up the second instance. So let's say that your target was 80% and the CPU stayed at 90% long enough to where the scheduler is like, hey, you know what? We need to go ahead and spin up another one. So it spins up that other one, and the other one, let's say for whatever reason, it's not getting used, right? So what would be a good, easy number to do here? Math. So if the second one spins up and it's only running at 30%, then as far as the horizontal pod autoscaling is going to be concerned at, the average utilization across the two pods is 60, because it's going to be the 90 plus 30 divided by 2. Well, if you take that same approach to the memory and you're only ever grabbing a consistent set amount, and you say, okay, if I'm going to grab 500 gigs of RAM up front, but if I'm ever using 90% of that, you know, spin or 80% spin up my second one, it would never do anything. Cause it would, as soon as it would hit, like, If you were only grabbing the 500, it's like, well, hey, guess what? You're using all 500. I'll spin up my second instance. Now it's going to be 500 plus 500 divided by 2. Oh, average utilization is 250.
Yeah.
Right. So memory makes for a horrible metric in the case, especially in the case of these Java apps where it's using a fixed amount of memory. That's why I was really hoping that you were telling me that the max ramp percentage would, like, you could set like an initial of like, hey, grab 80% of the limit. And if the, you know, going back to that example, if the limit was 10 gig and you said, grab 50%, so it grabs 5 gig, that maybe between the 5 gig that the JVM grabbed and maybe say, let's just say your operating system's super greedy, so it needed another gig, right? And so, like, as far as Kubernetes is concerned, that pod is only using 6 gigs of RAM, right? That's what I was hoping that you were telling me. And then, like, if it grew to 80%, it could still grow that way. As far as like the node is concerned, there's an amount requested and an amount limited up to, but there's still headroom on the node. You know what I'm saying?
No. Yeah. It doesn't do that. Shame, so, man. So to be perfectly clear here too, though, typically you mess with the JVM heap size when you notice performance issues in your app because of garbage collection and the heap being resized all the time, right? So that's when you even jack with these things. You do, however, sort of get the benefit of what you were saying, Outlaw, if you just use that use container support thing, because the JVM will take the RAM available.
Yeah, but it's still based off the limit.
It's still based off the limit. Yeah, you're not going to get any benefit out of it. Now, the interesting thing is, if you look at the metrics in your pods when they're running, it will show you. No, I think that's right. I think it's always going to pull that memory. Yeah, you're not going to win there. Yeah,
this is why, like, just generally as a rule of thumb, like, you can use memory and CPU as your metrics for your horizontal pod autoscaling, but you probably want to come up with a more meaningful metric that your bit app. Of code, your app, is going to like spit out that could be queried by the autoscaler to determine like if it's necessary, because there might be a better, for whatever your specific use case is, a better determination than just based on amount of memory. Cause you know, you might have like an app that's not CPU bound. So,
right.
You know, if it's not CPU bound, it could be super swamped, but you know, never use a lot of CPU.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. It's good to know about this so that Java can actually fully utilize what you're giving it, right? Like, if you didn't know that Java's only going to take 25% of the available RAM, you're wasting a lot of money on something that you think is doing something that's not, right?
Right.
So this is a great setting to have, even if you don't use the max and initial RAM percentages. One other property I want to share real quick. There is also, man, I learned so much as I crashed so many things. There's another property called max direct memory size. So there are buffers and whatnot in the JVM, especially if you're dealing with large file sizes, that can bite you, because if there's not enough memory allocated to this direct memory size, then a large file can kill it, right? Like, if you're trying to read bytes out of a stream or something like that, it'll actually blow up. Well, there is, I forget exactly how this is set. If you set the max direct memory size, then it's limited to that. If you don't set that and you have the heap stuff set up, like you were to say the max RAM percentage is, you know, 50% or whatever, then that direct memory size is also that same limit as the heap. So there's like these hidden property type things that if you set it this way, you could potentially be shooting yourself in the foot. And if you don't set it, then you have to know that it's based off this other number. So just know that there's a bunch of magic stuff that's happening in here that is especially important if you're running containers. So
it sounds like the real advantage, though, to using the first three, at least, is that you don't have to specify a specific numerical value for the memory. And instead, correct, you can just control that all through your YAML for your, yes, pod definition. And you're not like having to like enter this value in or calculate this value twice to, correct, figure out what you want. Instead, you're just like, you know, especially that use container support, you're like, hey, you know, I'm hoping you're going to play nicely with the OS and, you know, leave it some overhead. Yep. But, you know, if I wanted to do the max percentage thing, then, you know, I'm definitely allowing some overhead for the base operating system within the container.
Yep.
So, sure. Yeah, I still wish that it could play a little bit nicer in our cloud friendly world, Kubernetes friendly world.
Yep, for sure. So
yeah, as far as I know, there is no good workaround. It's just don't use the general guideline is try not to use RAM for autoscaling.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, for Java apps, period.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to say at all, because I'm, you know, it definitely, your mileage will vary. For Java apps, I definitely think it would be a bad choice.
Well, like Google even just recommends because of all, you know, all the types of things we mentioned, like Java's not the only thing that has issues with this. It's just that in general, there are problems with autoscaling and memory.
Yeah.
The CPU is still the king, unfortunately.
But that's unreliable too, though. It seems like it'd be easy,
but it's just not.
Yeah. So like in the case of our Java app, CPU is not going to tell you anything because it's never really taxing the CPU. It's working on a queue. And so really your indicators outside of the Java app, it's, hey, did my queue size grow past an amount that I'm comfortable with? If so, then maybe I need more of these things, right? So it's every single app's going to have different requirements. But yeah, in some cases, CPU nor memory are going to get you anywhere.
Yeah, I mean, like I think of another example that's not even related to cloud kind of world, but like every time I edit the audio for this show, I get so mad at my computer because I have this super beefy machine. And when I run it through some of the audio tools that I use to do the production of it, it never, like, it'll be churning away, but it's never like fully taxing anything, not my memory, not my GPU, not my CPU. And I'm like, just come on. But I like all the fans will kick in high gear. I hear it. Like, it thinks it's doing something, and I'm just watching it, and I'm like, all right, well, you know, were you made by Google? Because you're also lying to me.
Nothing.
I'm going to probably get, like, a nasty letter from Google. Hit me up at joe@slack.
No, what they're going to be like is, hey, do you want to help us make our documentation better? That would be amazing. And then you'd be like, no, I'd rather stick a pencil in my ear. Thanks.
Hey, it sounds like you're passionate about documentation.
Right? No, I meant somebody else should be. Yeah. I'm just passionate about using good documentation.
Yeah. All right. Well, talk to y'all later.
Man. No.
You won't talk to me later?
No, I won't.
That is so rude.
Not unless you check out our show notes at cuttingblocks.net/episode231. Yeah, 231. Yep.
Yeah, 231 question mark.
Yeah, yep. Question mark.
And while you're at it, you can send your feedback, questions, and rants to the Slack channel, and make sure to follow us on X.
Yeah. All right, now we're good.
Now that we post, we just like saying it.